Hi folks, welcome along to another episode of my podcast. I shall apologise immediately for my huskiness and deep voice this week. That's because I had the day and will have today as well at All Points East Festival in East London. Phenomenal day. So good. It was brilliant. As you can probably tell, I sung along quite a lot, hence why I have a slight graveliness to my voice. But that will not stop me bringing you another episode of the podcast. Now, slight change of plan, as was previously advertised. Last week, at the end of the show, I said I was bringing you Black Widow director Kate Shortland and composer Lauren Balfe. Slight change, because I was able to get time with a certain young lady who I'm very excited about. She's a previous guest on the podcast and has composed the music for a film that is out in cinemas at the minute that I really wanted to try and encourage you guys to go and see whilst it was still around. So hence why the change of plan. But my latest guest is a composer who we've had on the podcast before, but is appearing by herself for the first time. Emily Levenes-Farouche joined me, Carly Parody and Amelia Warner for a very special soundtrack in live at the BFI back in June 2019. Today, she's here to discuss her work on Censor, a smart, scary British horror which is out in cinemas now. Directed by Prano Bailey Bond and starring the phenomenal Neve Algar, the film tells the story of Enid, a video nasty censor who links a particularly disturbing movie with the disappearance of her sister. It is blimmin' brilliant, hence why I want to talk about it and encourage you guys to go and see it at the cinema. It's beautifully scored by Emily, of which plenty more shortly, but first, a word from our friends at Michelle Thomas, the audio-only language learning method that works with how your brain naturally learns, retains and retrieves information. Now, I've always had a real passion for language, and I think that kind of comes from being lucky enough to do quite a bit of travelling for work, but also the glorious world of foreign language film. I have this romantic notion of learning Spanish and being able to sit down and watch an Almodovar film without needing to read the subtitles, although I quite like reading subtitles. But the idea of actually learning a language can be pretty intimidating, I think, especially when life is just crazily hectic. Well, I'm glad to report that the Michelle Thomas method fits seamlessly into any schedule and situation. Thanks to its audio-only formatting, you can listen as you work from home, on your return to office commute, if you're lucky enough to be on a flight for your post-pandemic vacation, or curled up on your couch. Michelle Thomas is the ideal companion for learning a new language because it's stress-free, so you can relax or multitask whilst learning a new language. It's kind of like having a friend who speaks brilliant languages, being in the room with you, encouraging you as you learn. You'd be amazed how quickly you can start to speak and form your own sentences and delighted by your steady progress. The method's creator, Michelle Thomas, broke down entire languages into logical chunks or building blocks. And as a learner, you're presented with these building blocks in a logical order and slowly build up the complexity, helping you to say what you want when you want. Now, there are courses in 17 languages at varying levels. Whether you're starting from scratch, hoping to brush up your skills, like my French, or improve upon your existing vocabulary, this Take Anywhere audio course can be streamed online or via the Michelle Thomas Library app, which means you can listen wherever, whenever. And as a soundtrack and listener, we've got a fantastic offer for you with a massive discount for you to start or indeed continue your language journey. Simply visit michellethomas.com, that's michellthomas.com, select your desired language and course level and use the discount code SOUND at checkout and you can claim 25% off your purchase of any Michelle Thomas course. The Michelle Thomas Method, learn a language for good. And so to Emily and her score for Censor. We'll begin the conversation with her opening cue from the film Running from Death. It's so nice to welcome you back on to the podcast with your own episode and
so much to talk about. How are you?
I'm very good.
It's been very busy for you since we last spoke. You have been so in demand, working on so many brilliant projects. How exciting.
Yeah, it's actually, you're right. Like after we did the BFI episode, it really picked up a lot after Only You, really. And only really great projects. I'm so lucky about mm-hmm. that.
Let's talk about the most recent one that we've been privy to, which mm-hmm. people should go out and watch immediately, Censor. It's funny because I wouldn't normally levitate towards horror. Mm-hmm. It's not a genre that I'm a massive fan of and that I'm kind of like, you know, it's kind of, oh yeah, I need some horror in my life this week. But I was so drawn to this film for so many reasons. It was absolutely extraordinary. What a fantastic experience, and quite clearly what a fantastic example of great teamwork with the creatives. Would that be a fair thing to say?
Oh, for sure. I think Prano is a really original voice in her own accord, but I mean, the abilities she has to gather people and to find the right balance between guidance and genuinely be interested in what everyone has to bring to the project is just unparalleled. She's a great collaborator.
So tell me how Censor was presented to you, the idea, and how you met with Prano and got involved in the project, first of all.
Well, a friend of mine is a production designer, and she was starting on that feature film, and she kept on saying how good it was and how like nothing else it was. So I obviously wanted to find out more about it and kind of asked and begged if I could see a copy of the script. And they were kind enough to let me see a copy of the script, even though I'd never done any horror or anything like that before, apart from actually a short film with Rose Glass. So yes, I had done a small horror thing.
When you've done something with Rose Glass, though, you know that you're in good company and you're, totally.
But what was really interesting is that then when Prano wanted to know how I would approach the music, we kind of stayed with the script for a little bit. They had footage. They probably had an assembly at this stage, but she wanted to know. She was curious to know what in the story I would kind of latch on, what would Amazing. Speak to me the most, rather than telling me I want a retro score or anything. And from the pages, obviously what came through most wasn't necessarily the 80s aspect, but was Enid's personality.
Yeah.
And what was unraveling inside her head. So obviously when I started writing, I was inspired by her story. And so I wrote music before seeing any footage.
Wow.
And apparently that when they tried those pieces to the images, that kind of completely shifted the way you read those images. And yeah, I was like helping, in a sense, voicing what was going on inside Enid's head. So that was like super great when I found out that I had it. And that was because they thought my kind of empathy for the characters, for the character, was bringing something to the story, which is always super flattering.
Because it's interesting talking to different composers in terms of what they can draw, you know, inspiration from. And some of them need to see performance. Some of them write specifically to performance. Some of them deliberately don't want to see it. You know, some of them are in a script stage before anything's been shot. What do you think you wanted to convey with Enid's character, which is just, I mean, Niamh Alger's performance is, she deserves every award going for that performance. It is so powerful and so kind of nuanced and hidden, and oh, it's so great. I think she's brilliant. But what was it you connected with in terms of when you started to write? What were you trying to say? And in terms of also how you chose to express that creatively in the instrumentation that you went for, or the kind of melody or the sonic sounds that you chose to reflect that?
I think I felt very sorry for her because she was experiencing grief and shame and powerlessness. And I think what was really interesting in her character is her inability to communicate. She can't communicate things because she can't remember some of those things, so she can't express them. But also, like, you can tell that even though her family is very loving, there is an inability to talk openly on her side as well, even though her mother is clearly trying to still reach out to her, but she just can't open up. I just felt a lot of that sound palette is actually my voice, that sometimes is recorded on the chest, sometimes is often really close mic'd. And the way I like to think about it is like she's trying to soothe herself. Like she would just hum herself to sleep or just try to appease herself. And I was trying to like EQ a lot of the top end for that bass layer of manipulated vocal, because it would just be like she would hear it in her own head. So I was just trying to create this sense of loneliness and intimacy and repressed voice through the vocals, and then having some vocals that are less treated that could at first be almost mistaken, like this classic horror thing of having this kind of high-pitched voice in the distance that could be her sister's, but really all of it is hers.
Yeah. Wow, that's amazing. That's the hairs on my arms just stood on end when you're talking about that. Connection to make with that as well, and also just the way to represent that. And I guess as well, there's that added layer of having to navigate your way through it, of, you know, within this film, obviously, the character Enid is a censor, and she's has to watch all these films that obviously have, you know, score or elements of kind of score on them. And so was that something that was a job that you had to do, or was that, or how did that work? Because I was kind of watching it going, God, this must have been like so much work for you.
So I only did the kind of score, but the sound designer, Tim Harrison, is the legend. And he actually created, for all the kind of moments where you cross the corridors and you just hear like little snippets of sound coming from the other rooms, he created very, very, very period accurate scores for all those kind of films that you only, and it's just such a commitment because some of them you're going to hear for like 30 seconds. But yeah, he just created all this amazing library of period sounding music to create just a really great sound design for the whole, for the whole film. So again, another situation where Prano just found the craziest people she could, the most committed people for the film.
I was looking back at my notes, and what the thing I wrote down about your score is the music is a state of mind, you mm-hmm. know, in terms of, that's what I kind of almost kind of really felt, is that it does so much more than a script, you know, the vocabulary can really, in a way, I think.
I agree. And I agree. Thank you, Robert. Wow. Okay. Yeah. But it's a subjectivity in a sense, like even in the later stage of the film where when we go into the moment where the film shifts a little bit, I kind of always imagined that it's more the way Enid in her head kind of hears that shift. So instead of going full period, we kind of, we're going to take little bits and bobs that she would have heard in films and incorporate it with her palette. And it's the state of mind, it's Enid's state of mind from A to Z. And when that state of mind kind of goes into a slightly more unreal place, we are starting to bring those elements from all the films she's watched throughout the year into that state of mind.
Yeah, when she's creating her narrative of what she wants truth to be, basically.
Yep.
Yep. Oh man, yeah. And it's really interesting because the opening piece over all the other films is kind of opening piece. Was that you, and did you, how was that sort of, because it's also when you talk about how you, where you started and you wrote stuff before you'd even seen anything. And then I guess it's a case of between you and Prano working out where and what is required for the film musically.
So the opening, you mean the first film, the very first images we see. Yeah, this one was it was interesting because we needed something that just wouldn't tell too much to the audience whether they were watching the start of our story or something else. So it had to be a little bit more retro than the score, but still not a full kind of 80s music. So it was just trying
too predictable.
Exactly.
Yeah. Did you spend much, did you do much research in terms of, you know, that the era that the film's set and that whole kind of genre within that era and the scores that were being created around that time and what they were saying, the good ones and the bad ones, I guess, as well. There's a lot of bad ones from that time.
I think I'm lucky that some of my, like some of the scores I really, really love in horror are from the time, and also scores that Prano loves. So, you know, Goblin, Suspiria is just obviously an amazing score. The Beyond, The Fog. I'm a huge Carpenter fan. I love the really kind of simple way he uses synths and like repetitive motives in the film. So there was already like a lot of that bass that I was very familiar with. And then I had a little bit of homework, in terms of, because I wasn't familiar at all with the Video Nasty phenomenon. Well, I mean, it's interesting because a lot of the films on the banned list are films that I have seen.
Yeah.
But I wasn't really aware that they were such a scandal when they came out. So there was an interesting shift in mentality and kind of understanding that, you know, Texas Chainsaw Massacre wasn't always a masterpiece. At some point, it was just a really shocking film. You know, I was encouraged to watch things like Cannibal Holocaust, which isn't really a pleasant movie to watch. But thankfully, because Prano didn't really want to do pastiche, I just had to kind of lift a few elements from those classic scores. So I didn't have to do too much research in terms of using exactly the same synthesizer or things like that. There's a few, you know, in the cabin or the later stage of the film, I'm using the flanger effect because that's a very 70s and 80s. A little organ effect. So just, you know, little sounds that are very recognizable from the time, but we didn't want to go too far into the Video Nasty sound world. When we were doing that sequence, I think what's really interesting in that sequence is that there's a lot of humor, but you kind of want to keep people within it. And we found that sometimes if we were going a little bit too far in the retro sounds, it kind of took us out of what's going on inside of our head. And it made it funnier because a lot of those sounds for like a modern ear, they sound a little bit funny, you know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
So it was an interesting balance to find.
I think it's almost interesting for people who are very familiar with this era and genre of filmmaking watching this film, as to someone who's coming into it completely, you know, blind sort of thing. It'd be interesting to have discussions with those two and have that discussion. But I also was thinking about things like Candyman, and having like someone like Philip Glass, who had never really done horror before, you know, and kind of slightly take him out of his kind of not comfort zone, but that I think as well can be so revelatory, if that's the kind of right term of phrase, in terms of what they can bring to that type of filmmaking as well. Was that a kind of excitement for you to really attack a real genre kind of piece, I guess?
Well, I don't know why, what was Philip Glass's motivation for his great Candyman score, but I think what's really attractive in horror, and I suspect it's the same thing for all the craft department, is it's one of the genre of film where you can experiment and the audience will react really positively to you just pushing the envelope and trying something new. The audience for the genre craves something they've never seen before. They love being surprised. They love, being terrified by something they've never seen before. So, you know, musically, sonically, yeah, for me, that was the main attraction. It's just, I knew I could push myself in area and direction and sound world that I would not be able to do in drama or in comedy. So, yeah, for a musician, it's so attractive.
I love that notion, though, as well, that you're not creating score to, like you say, like scare the audience or manipulate the audience. You're writing score purely based on the emotion of the character. Mm-hmm. And then it's up to the audience how they react to heart and that. I love that.
Yeah, I think it's what's, for me, it's the base of all the music I write. I need to find an emotion. I love having a really nice conceptual structure, like a conceptual mold, and then I just pour emotion into that. But if I don't have an emotional attachment to what's going on the screen or in the story, I can't write anything. I think a lot of musicians are the same. They just kind of translate emotions into sound.
Were you privy to the closing credits track as well, in terms of what that was going to be as well?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think they were in love with that track for a very long time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But do you have to think about that in terms of what you're writing that's leading up to the moment when that piece of music comes in, really, you know, in terms of sonically, so that it doesn't feel like a kind of a jolt or, you know, but in a way it kind of is, but it's meant to be, you know, in terms of...
Yeah, I think the, in a sense, yeah, my, the final cue does have a sense of closure because we're kind of contracting and the vocals are dying down and everything is kind of dying down. So yeah, I was keeping in mind the fact that we should close that part of the story and then let, you know, the blank mass track just go big as we completely shift gear again for the final time. So yeah, I kept it in consideration in the shape of the score, but it was there. It was there from the start, so I knew I was working around that one.
I can't wait to see it again, actually. I think it's one of those films that I'm going to watch again and again and again. And almost every experience, you either find something new in it, but just, yeah, I think it's so good. I think it's going to go down as one of those kind of real kind of classics that people in years to come are going to be talking about in the same way we've been talking about, you know, you're talking about John Carpenter and Suspiria, the original Suspiria and Candyman and things like that. So, yeah. Bravo. Yeah.
Thank you. I hope you get to see it in the cinema also, because I had seen it so many times working on it, but I've seen it in the cinema and I must say that I'd forgotten that one of the pleasure, especially of watching horror with other people, is the funny bits. Just everyone kind of has a laughter of relief at the same time and everyone jumps at the same jump scares. And yeah, if you feel comfortable going to the cinema to watch it, I really recommend experiencing it with other people.
Yeah, I've got a couple of mates who are really excited to see it. So we're going to try and go and see it next week. I have to talk to you about Rocks as well, please. What a film. Oh, and I've been lucky enough to do a couple of things that have involved being in the presence of I think she's a prophet, Buki Bakre. She's just a phenomenal human being. And I mean, she's got this aura and presence about her that is, you know, she's been here before, she's been there and done it. And she's just an extraordinary talent. And I'm so glad that Sarah and the team allowed her to kind of shine and show that as this character. And yeah, do you mind talking a little bit about how you became involved in Rocks and what was the attraction of being part of this project?
I think this one was a bit later than Sansa. I think they already had most of the film was edited, and I think they just had a lot of the songs and they just needed a little bit of score to, again, it was an interest. There's kind of a similarity in the sense that I was there to show us what's happening inside Shola's Rock's heart. Mm-hmm. So for me, it was again like a situation of feeling extremely compassionate and extremely protective of a character, and just wanting to like express the subtlety of what was going on in her heart. And yeah, it was a project. You see the edit, and you just know, you just know the performances that are just radiating out of the screen.
was that idea then of you know, writing for that character, were you reacting to Bookie's performance then for that?
Yeah. It was already, I think we were quite far in the edit when I saw it the first time. And it was just also the way it's filmed, like the cinematography is beautiful and just the way the camera lingers on her face. And you can, what's extraordinary with her performance is you can tell that there's a lot that she's not saying, but you can just see it flicker at the surface. And yeah, it was just that that I needed to tap into and just subtly highlight it. It was just really
beautiful. What I felt, so many great, and Kosar Ali as well. What she's just, oh, they're just, the casting on that film was just absolutely extraordinary. It deserves all the praise and recognition that it got and continues to get as well. So if you haven't seen Rocks yet, get it, watch it multiple times. What's the preferred sort of entry point for you with a project? When do you like to be brought on board and kind of, or is every project slightly, you know, different? Like with Rocks, for example, if you'd been brought on early and you hadn't been witness to Bookie's performance, would the score, it might, you know, what you wrote might have been different?
I think it's nice to be on board early, but I don't think you necessarily need to write music early. But again, because of this kind of, and I think all composers are different, but because I've started on a new project right now, and you know, I'm starting to build that person in my head and really trying to understand his motivation, his past, and just trying to create a little version of that person in my head, which I'm then going to use as like the start of the music. So the longer I have to kind of understand the character and feel really connected to the character, even if I'm not writing yet, but the longer I have for that process, the better in a sense. And also because I want to understand this character on the same page as the director, it's nice to have a little bit of time to exchange and not necessarily talk about music, but just be like, so why is he doing this at this point? And what do you think his childhood was like? And, you know, all this kind of conversation that allow you to tap into the right emotions. So the earlier, the better.
And where do you start in terms of writing? Do you sit at the piano? Do you sit at a keyboard or with a guitar? Yeah. Or again, is it, you know, is there a sound or a, you know, physical attachment to an instrument calling out from what you've read or what you think for the character or the score, the story narrative?
It varies. I think I do like to have a kind of ideas in terms of sounds. You're going to have some sounds that kind of jump up at you. What a character, you feel, or maybe a bass clarinet is going to be a really good expression of that person's personality. And sometimes because of the story set at a certain time, some instruments are going to be more logical. But when it comes to the melody, it's going to be the piano. Mm. I think it's just because I've played it for so long that it just comes out that way a lot easier than any other way, for sure.
Can you talk about what's next, or is it too early?
I don't think it's been announced yet. Okay. So I don't think
that we don't want to, you know, that's fine, we get it, we totally understand all of that.
But I have a film, World War II film, a Dutch film, that's going to be coming to Netflix in mid-October.
Oh, great.
Forgotten Battle.
Oh yes, I saw this. I haven't seen it yet, but I got an email about it. Tell me a little bit about this. I'm not even going to try and pronounce the director's name because it's... Matthias? Is that
Matthias?
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah. Yes, so there is Tom Felton, and it follows three young people from different sides, which is quite interesting because you have an English pilot, a young woman who is in occupied Zealand, and a young Dutchman who picked the wrong side and is fighting for Germany. And it's kind of the way their three story weave into one another in one of the battles that was kind of decisive in order to bring supply to the Allies for the liberation.
Wow.
And it's just, the cinematography is absolutely incredible. The battle scenes are incredible. And I cry like a baby when I watch it, even though I've seen it so many times, because the performances, like those young actors just gave it everything. And yeah, I'm very, very excited for people to see it. I've never seen it in the cinema, which is huge regret, but you know, with I'm the sure travel that can... situation, it was
yeah. tricky. What was required of you for that? Because with films, you know, with that subject matter, you imagine it's big. You imagine mm-hmm. it being kind of, you know, highly emotive as well, you know, in yeah. terms of not just the action, but the emotion that's going through these characters.
Well, I think what was important from the side of the director, and I completely agreed with that, which is also why I was really excited to do this project, is that it didn't want it to feel patriotic or victorious, or it wanted to really show how heart-wrenching and destructive war is, and how very young people are being asked to make extreme decisions at a time when they might not be exactly old enough to pick a side or to make a decision that might lead to their death. And I think this kind of approach to war was something that I felt was very important. And then in terms of scope, it was during lockdowns, so we had to see a little bit smaller than we would have done otherwise, but still managed to, between lockdown, record at Air Studio with DLCO. I think we had 16 musicians and then a few soloists, and I played the piano, and yeah, it was...
Is that special to be back in a room with live musicians? Oh, and... Did you cry then too?
I couldn't cry because I was, you know, the lady in charge. So I had to pretend that I wasn't over emotional. But yes, I hadn't seen any live music for 6 months, and it was music that I had written in a studio. So yeah, I got a bit emotional.
Yeah. I think the first thing I saw music-wise was Laura Marling at the Royal Albert Hall with a 16-piece string orchestra. And, oh, my makeup was running down my face. I was supposed to be on telly, just like literally like just black mascara dripping down my face. It's the power of it. It's so powerful. Just that, the being in the room with it. I mean, you know, kind of watching films in a cinema at home, whatever, you absolutely feel the power of music, but there is nothing that beats being in a room and feeling. And I saw that you'd been at the Proms this week.
Was that for,
yeah, and Jules Buckley. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh my God. Again, I think 5 minutes in, I was like, I might start crying, but if I start now, I'm not going to stop. And I can't just cry for an hour and a half. That's just not okay. But it was just so overwhelming. And I think it was his first show in 18 months as well. So everyone was just giving it everything and feeling so lucky to be in that room together.
Yeah, amazing. Listen, since we last spoke, I think that, you know, we were so excited to speak to you when we did that, the BFI with you and Carly and Amelia. But in terms of, as a composer, what you've done since that point and the variety of things, you know, this beautiful love story in Only You and Rocks, this incredible, you know, kind of important British drama, World War II epic and Censor, this horror. The world is your oyster in terms of what you can do. But I think how you do it is just absolutely brilliant. I'm so excited to see where you go next. I really, really am.
Thank you. Oh, and by the way, I don't know if you remember when you did an Invader interview.
Yeah.
And you told them maybe they should, you know, work with me at some point.
Yeah.
They're releasing Sansa.
Yes! Are they?
You made it happen.
Yes, Jeff. Yes, Reg. Oh, they're a great bunch. They are so important when it comes to, you know, and that story that Reg told about the Drive soundtrack was just hilarious, I thought, as well. But I just think that their heart's in the right place, and it's all about the greater good of the music and the composer and making sure that you know, it's out there for people to hear and have the chance to enjoy it. When do you know when it's going to be released?
Well, there's a little bit of a complicated pressing plant issue that's slowing down a lot of releases. And I mean, what's amazing with Invader is they very much want the best quality vinyl to come out. They don't want to rush anything.
Yeah.
So it might be a bit longer than we hoped, but it's going to be, you know, a great pressing of the score, which is the most important thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And there is nothing wrong with the film bedding into people's brains and lives to then have the luxury of getting the score for Christmas or... that's great news. Oh, that's such good news. Well, listen, I'm so excited to, you know, when you can tell us what's next. I follow you, you know, your social media. So I'll be watching with bated breath till you can announce what you are doing next. But please come back and have another chat if you have the time.
It is a great pleasure.
Oh, and it's great to have you back. And I'm so thrilled for you and what you've been doing. It's exciting. Yeah.
Well, thanks, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me again.
Take care, lovely.
Bye.
Thanks so much. Bye. Stay safe.
You too.
Bye, love.
Bye. We'll be right back.
From her score to Censor, that's the title track by Emily Livanese Farouche, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking with the French composer. My huge thanks to Emily for taking the time to talk to us. Censor is in cinemas now, and I highly recommend you seeing it on the big screen, if you are, of course, comfortable doing so. Whether you are a horror fan or not, you will be highly rewarded. And watch this space with regards to the vinyl release via our very good friends at Invader Records. And if you want to hear my chat with Jeff Barrow and Reg Weeks from Invader, head over to edithbowman.com, where you can also find the soundtrack in live with Emily, Carly and Amelia Warner. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. We are at Soundtracking UK. Please tell me what you've been to see at the cinema or you've been watching at home. I love hearing what you've been watching. And also which episodes of the podcast you have been particularly enjoying. Head over to edithbowman.com. As I said, that's where you can find them all. And please do subscribe to our YouTube channel for Soundtracking Extra, a little show that I put together with guests from the podcast and a few others too. Next up, we can finally share our doubleheader of Black Widow director Kate Shortland and composer Lorne Balfe, who I'm very excited to welcome back to the podcast. Of course, we talk Black Widow, and with Lorne, maybe a few other things too. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.